I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is something very strange about this moment in America's economy. It really does seem like the very best of times and the very worst of times. Look at hotel bookings. There is a big jump in demand for ritzy rooms at the Hilton. Revenues are up over 10%. But match that against Motel 6 and you find business for America's roadside rooms is way down. The market for high-end jewelry and fine art is hot, while many Americans are looking at their paycheck and wondering how they can afford $2 a gallon gas and what's now close to $4 a gallon for milk. If it is two Americas, which one is yours? If it is a more classic version of those two Americas, is that such a bad thing? Is the promise of moving on up still not part of every American dream? Or is this country, as some people are suggesting, settling into a much more rigid definition of the haves and the have-nots? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're starting today's program at the brighter end of this spectrum. For 75 years now, East Coasters have admired the yachts designed and built in the yard of Benjamin B. Hinckley in Southwest Harbor, Maine. Even today, these boats, some with their million-dollar price tags, are the envy of the yachter's world. Phil Bennett is senior salesman with the Hinckley Company, and he's in Southwest Harbor. Hello, Phil.
Good morning.
You've been through, I gather, a couple of quiet years. What about this year?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's booming, but it's certainly showing signs of hope. We went through some very quiet years because, as you might imagine, when things get tough, the first thing to go are luxury items. And so 2 years ago, all boat builders and a lot of luxury goods manufacturers were wondering when their next sale was going to come and from where. We're fortunate as a company in that we were able to weather that, but it certainly was not the growth during that time or the sales record that we had anticipated. So, but we're recovering slightly now.
Who's buying now, Phil? Who are the clients?
It's a good question because people often feel that our clients are only the wealthy, and it couldn't be further from the truth. Obviously, to buy a second home or to buy, in lieu of a second home, in some cases, a boat, built by the Hinckley Company, there has to be a certain measure of disposable income. So, you know, typically the people that buy our boats, their basic needs have been met, whether it's, you know, transportation or housing or whatever. But from that point on, our buyer profile really varies from people who are, you know, perhaps some of the wealthiest people in the world to those who are working, for example, in running a painting company day to day, painting homes, and yet they've for a long time aspired to own a boat or spend time on the water, and for that reason, now they feel more confident they're going to go finance the purchase of a vessel.
What's the shift that you're seeing here, Phil? Why now? Why do you think people are saying, you know what, I'm going to spend that money now?
It's dramatic. Perhaps it's I shouldn't say dramatic as much as is vividly perceptible. I've been involved in the boat business for almost 32 years now professionally, and you know I know that our boats are considered a luxury item. I mean, some people even just call them yachts. They don't call them boats. You know, it's a yacht, and it gets a stigma almost attached to it. And yet, if you ask people what they would like to do with their free time, a huge number would love to go and go sailing or go on the water or go on a boat.
But not a huge number of us can afford, what, I don't know, $100,000, $500,000 for one of these craft to do that.
Absolutely. But it's a want for many, many people. And so what I've found is that over the years, people always kept saying, well, if when this happens or when that happens, when we get to world peace, when we get to total sanity in Washington, when we get to anything, there's a great folk song, and I've forgotten now, I'm embarrassed, the lyricist, but it talks about when this event happens, then my life will be perfect. And I think for many, many years, I saw people using that as a criteria for their buying trigger. They say, when everything gets right, then I will go ahead and I'll afford this. Now what I see, and perhaps it's colored by the events of 9/11 and other events in the world, but they're getting the realization that time is not an infinite thing for them. It's certainly infinite in terms of its overall perspective, but for them it's finite. And I see people now saying, I'm not going to wait for world peace. I'm not going to wait for the perfect governmental situation. I'm going to live my life, and in particular, they're valuing time
Well, that's just sort of throw your hands in the air. Might as well spend the money. I could be dead tomorrow, right?
Yeah, although it's not fatalistic. You know, it's not. It's not that. It's not. Oh, I'm going to just go blow it all and not worry about it. What it really is it's more of, I find, people valuing time with their children and time with their families much more than I've ever seen before, and that's creating, you know, not just buying yachts, but again, a lot of the people that are buying our boats have second homes in places like Nantucket, and Eggertown, and you know, nice home, you know, shorefront properties. And I see them saying to me, you know, I've dedicated all my life to working and building this company, but I'm going to take, you know, X number of weeks off because I really want to spend it, you know, with my family, with my kids. My kids are going to a camp up here in Maine, for example. I want to stop in and see you, but you don't call me, or nothing is going to happen regarding my business during that time because I'm spending time with my family. And I see that as a big shift in American culture right now.
Phil, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today. It's nice to hear from you.
Nice speaking with you.
Phil Bennett is Senior Sales Director with the Hinckley Yacht Company in Southwest Harbor, Maine. I want to bring Josh Bivens into the conversation here. Josh is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute, focusing on trade and labor markets, macroeconomic things. Hi, Josh.
Hi.
There are some pretty good statistics to bear out part of what Phil Bennett's talking about, just in simple terms, that there are a lot more wealthy families in America than there were 20 years ago, right?
That's almost surely true. I mean, we've seen a lot of economic growth in general over the past 20 years, and we've also seen most of the fruits of that economic growth go to sort of the upper end of the income distribution. So yeah, the number of people who can afford luxury items, second homes, is surely increased a lot in that time.
And is it also accurate to say that that part of the population is now or never really did stop spending, that they want the yachts, that they want the gold rings and things like that?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. This recession, if followed by the relatively weak recovery so far, has actually been a little more egalitarian than other ones. You've seen some workers who are generally insulated from recessions feeling a bit of a pinch. But there is still a pretty big group who kept their well-paying jobs through the recession and the recovery. And then you had the phenomenon of huge increase in house prices that enabled a lot of people to take cash out of their homes and keep spending that way. So yeah, there's definitely a group that was able to spend right through the hard times.
And is it reasonable to say that's one end of the spectrum? There's this other group that doesn't have the wherewithal. But the interesting part for trying to figure out what's going on with the economy right now is looking at what used to be and what is today in between those two groups.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to say it. I mean, we have, from sort of the late 70s to about 1995, 96, we had an economy that was rapidly pulling apart in terms of income, and we had a huge increase in inequality. That pulling apart sort of stabilized in the second half of the 1990s for a brief couple years, and now I think what we're seeing now is not something brand new, but sort of a reassertion of that pulling apart. But it's even, I would argue, more extreme in the past 2 to 3 years than it even was back in the previous time.
I want to hear from Larry Greenbaum here. So, Josh, just hang on for a second. Larry's a director with Jewish Vocational Services in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's joining us on the phone. Hi, Larry.
Hi there.
Tell me what you're seeing at the Employment Training and Career Development Office. A lot of people looking for work?
We're not seeing a lot of people who are buying gold or buying yachts. That's one thing. We are seeing about 2,700 people a year, and we're seeing an awful lot of people who have been who have lost their jobs, who have been displaced from their jobs, and are spending over a year to 2 years finding another job.
What kind of work are they coming from, Larry?
They're coming from all kinds of work, but basically you're talking about people who have been solid employees, ranging anywhere from managerial people down to the lower levels of bench assembly and manufacturing, and their companies were either sold or merged or engaged in work slowdowns or whatever, and they are not having a good time in finding employment.
You don't have anything for them?
It's not that we don't have anything for them, because we're an organization that provides career development assistance, employment assistance, training, but we're not calling companies and having...
Yeah, but you're not able to steer them into jobs that are necessarily at the same level?
We are trying, but that is not... not happening to the extent that it needs to.
Is it proper, Larry, for us to talk about a hollowing out of the middle class when we try to make sense of what's happening with the jobs? I mean, I read in the paper this morning that 1 million jobs were created in the last 4 months, and that's not just because it's summer and farm time. But I don't, you know, when I hear from you, I'm going, so where are those?
Yeah. We hear that, too. We hear, well, there's been an increase in jobs, but if you look at the overall number of people working, they're basically not any more working than there were before, from what we're seeing. I think there is a kind of hollowing out or a kind of erosion, if you will, of that middle management or middle-level employment opportunity. And I think it comes from a number of things. I think it comes from the slowdown in the economy, the market, the care that employers are taking and being careful not to rehire too quickly or too fast. But I also think a lot of it is coming from the basic restructuring of our economy that's been going on for a long time now with globalization and outsourcing and the whole speed of the economy, the whole fact that employers are not having to look to the traditional worker to get things done all the time.
So if some woman comes in, 35, 45 years old, had a good job, lost that job, are they saying it's just a matter of time, I am going to get back in at that level? Are you seeing people, you know, sort of have their confidence worn away?
We're seeing people trying to get it back at the level they were at, but we're seeing them a year to 2 years later settling for employment, which is way under what they did before and essentially underutilizes them and puts them and their family in some real economic jeopardy. It's just a fact, and it's especially true in the manufacturing positions. And then when you go back to get another job, let's say in the manufacturing field, even when there are openings, those openings come with much more specific requirements, so that if somebody came from one industry and is trying to transfer it to another, like the medical, we have a lot of medical instrument manufacturing here in the Twin Cities, and that requires very specific training. So if you don't have the experience and the training, it's one of those kind of cyclical things where you don't have a job because you don't have the experience, but you don't have the experience so that you can't get the job.
Are these people talking about the two Americas? I'm either a have or I'm a have not?
I think what we're seeing is not so much that part as their own focus on their own needs.
Right.
But I think that as this goes on, that's clearly a direction in which we may be headed.
Larry, thanks for being with us on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Larry Greenbaum, director with the Jewish Vocational Services Office in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Josh Bivens is staying with us to help us look at the current state of the economy as we try to make sense of the way you see it. Are there two Americas? Are you on one side or the other? Do you see the opportunity to move forward? It used to be that the middle class was that stepping stone. Is it still there? Is it still something that you see ahead of you? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Is there an economic divide in this country that is getting wider if you're on the lower end? Could you imagine yourself ever walking into a boatyard in southwest Maine and say, I'd like to have a yacht like that? Or are those options disappearing for you, for your kids? Tell us how you're looking at the economy right now. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Josh Bivens is with us. He's an economist at the Economic Policy Institute. We're going to bring James Sirwicki in as well. James writes the financial page for The New Yorker. Hello, James.
How are you?
I'm fine. Tell me what you're thinking as you listen to the Phil Bennett version of the world as he sees it and what Larry has to say.
Well, I think obviously the fact of rising inequality is pretty much indisputable. I mean, that's something that's been going on, as Josh said, for quite some time. But I do think that one of the things about this recovery that has been curious is that although you have this a weak job market, I mean, I think that's really the source of everything that's been going on. So it isn't so much that, people who are working are getting sort of paid significantly less than they were or compensated significantly less than they were. It's just that the number of people working has dropped significantly. I mean, you mentioned the million jobs that have been created, in the last 4 months. But part of the problem is that with the rate of growth of the U.S. population, you need to create that many jobs on a pretty regular basis just to sort of keep the workforce intact. And, I think that business has really been very cautious to hire. I think, that goes all the way back to coming out of the recession. I think the, drumbeat of war around Iraq had a lot to do with it. But I think, even going forward, we've still seen an enormous amount of caution on the part of businesses. And at this point in a recovery, you normally would expect them to be expanding far more than they are.
Is that caution, James, why we see companies like Microsoft, stacking up $75 billion in the photocopy room and saying, gosh, what are we going to do with all this money?
Well, Microsoft is a little bit of a unique situation because they are making so much money every year that it's and because of the nature of their business, it's a little bit hard to see exactly what they're supposed to do in terms of hiring necessarily. I mean, Microsoft spends an enormous amount of money every year on research and development and, on employee compensation. So,
but there are companies hoarding, right?
Yeah. In fact, that's the column I'm writing next week is a column about how strange it is that I think the amount of cash on hand in corporations has roughly doubled since 2000. And, I think what's happened in part is that, in the coming immediately out of the stock market bubble bust, companies saw themselves getting rewarded for, being tight-fisted, for running very lean operations. Stock prices rose really sharply between 2001 and 2003. And I think, businesses basically said, well, we're just going to run as lean an operation as possible. But the problem is, I think, going forward, that's not really a recipe for success, either for the economy as a whole or, frankly, either for businesses either. So I think
– let me, if I can, James, bring Josh in here because, Josh, this is something I know that you're studying as well, this difference between just the amount of profit that's kicking around, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The corporate profits have just soared since the recession started and since the recovery began. And you've just seen, as James pointed out, no equivalent gain in labor compensation. And at the same time, as these corporate profits are growing, you still see really weak investment by U.S. companies when you look at the aggregate numbers. In fact, if you take out – there's a sector that you can take out from the Federal Reserve statistics that's high-tech firms, and you take them out, and investment is just incredibly anemic at the same time as you see these corporate profits piling up. And so I hadn't heard this before, but I have to say you add those two things together and it's no shock that you have lots of companies with lots of cash who still seem kind of unwilling to pull the trigger either on investment or hiring.
Why that caution? The sort of hallmark of this country's economy is a little bit of money comes in and it's where do we want to go with research and development? How can we turn this small amount of money into an investment that's going to make the company grow? Why are people still so tentative?
Well, I think to be fair, or at least reasonable, I think that if you think about the late 1990s when you had this kind of orgy of investment, if you take the telecom business where something like $600 billion was invested in fiber optic networks, most of which are now not being used, I think it's natural that there would be some kind of hangover, both practically in the sense that there was a lot of overinvestment, so there's a lot of capacity out there, but also I think just psychologically in a way that there was a sense of, we went too far and now we need to pull back. But I do think that, going forward, these enormous profits that Josh talked about, you're not going to be able to keep reaping those unless you invest. And so businesses are going to have to, I'll just say they'll have to decide. CEOs have a lot of, power and leverage over what they do. But if they want to continue to earn those profits, they're going to need to start putting some money into the business.
Let's go to Hampton, Virginia. Lee's waiting on the line there. Hi, Lee.
Hi, good morning.
What do you think?
Well, you've asked the question earlier about was Kennedy right when he talked about as the tide rises,
all boats are lifted at the same, right?
Right. And, if you have people who are making a lot of money and they've been successful, buy a large yacht. At the blue-collar level, somebody's got to fix those things. Somebody's got to maintain the pier. Somebody's got to sell them the gas. Somebody's going to have to fix a thing. And another thing on that, if I do good in life, maybe I can buy that boat off of them when it's used.
So when you hear that there are people lining up and looking at million-dollar yachts. For you, that's an indication that, that there are better times ahead?
Oh, yeah. I plan on making money as I get older. A certain time in my life, I can relax. You know, if you work hard enough in life, you might be one of those people. And if not, you know, so be it. Maybe you'll buy a used one, but we're all in it together.
It is a classic sort of piece of the way that we're taught as individuals to understand the economy. Josh Bivens, is Lee far off when we take a look at what's happening in at Southwest Harbor? Is that an indication that the whole economy can take some encouragement from?
Not a whole lot, I would say. It's true that in some sense we're all in it together, but I'd argue a couple decades ago we were much more in it together. Our fortunes were more closely tied. I think what's more and more characterizing our economy is that you do have sort of subsectors of the economy doing better than others, and it doesn't necessarily portend great things down the road for sort of a broader group.
So the guy who pumps the gas for the yacht, the person who maintains it, can't realistically expect that someday he or she will also own a yacht?
I think that's right. I mean, I would be much more encouraged if you had sort of a broad recovery across sort of a variety of economic sectors. I think when it's sort of concentrated in a couple select ones, it's hard. And, of course, these are anecdotes, so they're all going to be a little concentrated.
Yeah.
But when I hear that the yacht business is booming, I sure don't then go, well, that means good times right around the corner for everybody else. I don't think that's exactly right.
Okay, go ahead, Lee.
Well, I disagree. I mean, I live the blue-collar life, and you know, if I got more yachts in a yacht club, that's more money all the way down. And it goes with cars, clothes, anything. And if we're seeing a boom in sales in something that's as fragile as that market, you know, there's money out there and it's being spent. And like I said, if, you know, maybe somebody can afford cable TV that they couldn't afford last month.
Right.
You never know. And like I said, it might sound like trickle-down economics. But like I said, I think Kennedy was right, and that's basically what he was talking about.
There is, though, James, help me with your perspective on this. There are people who are saying, yeah, but, and the but is that globalization has finally caught up with the American economy, that it will not fill out again in that center zone the way that our parents saw it happen, we saw it happen, and we can expect the same thing for our kids. What do you make of that?
Well, I frankly am a little uncomfortable with assuming or even arguing that there's been some major structural shift in the U.S. economy in the last 3 years, which is essentially what that argument amounts to. Because, you know, from 96 to 2001, 97 to 2001, you saw the, first really sustained growth in wages and income for, well, essentially for all Americans, but in particular for Americans in the, say, bottom half and sort of middle two-thirds of the income spectrum. So, that was only a few years ago. Now, it may be, as Josh suggested, that was just a blip in the context of a longer trend. But I do think that the last few years have been, if you think about it, a lot has gone on, beginning with 9/11,
okay.
Iraq, et cetera. And those are all things that have magnified enormously uncertainty. And we know that one of the things businesses hate is uncertainty. So it's perhaps, I think we need to be cautious about making big statements about the structural changes that are happening. But can I say one thing? I do think that there is one massive issue here that we haven't touched on yet, and that is the rising cost of benefits. Because one of the really strange things about this recovery is if you look at compensation to workers, so total compensation that employed people are getting,
right.
It has not fallen at all. The numbers are roughly the same over the last 3 years as they were in the previous 3 years. But the lion's share – well, I shouldn't say the lion's share of that, but wages and income have been relatively flat. So what's really been driving that is this incredible cost rise in the cost of benefits, primarily being healthcare, I guess. And so that is a major factor. And I think that also has a lot to do with businesses' hesitation to hire, because the
certainly
thing about
to hire full-time benefit
right.
Employees. I want to move along to Hamilton, Massachusetts now. Ruth's on the line. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
What do you see from your perspective?
Well, I'm a teacher, so I'm used to stagnant wages. Well, and my benefit costs, as you were just mentioning, have definitely gone up. I'm in actually a pretty good position because I've been at the same school for 20 years.
Yeah.
But I really feel for people at the other end of the scale, and I really feel for the families that I work with at school, because I've seen many parents laid off. And as the headlines were blaring the recovery, I certainly couldn't see it. in the parent population where I work, because people remained unemployed, or if they did get a job, it was far below what they had previously had for work, and they were not making the same kind of money at all.
Ruth, teaching is one of those sort of classic middle-class jobs. I say that with pride as the son of a teacher myself.
It's the CD of Certificate of Deposit of Jobs. It doesn't make pay a lot, but, you know, it lasts.
But if you look at the younger student, or so the younger people who are coming in to teach right now, are they coming in with the same benefits, with the same confidence that you began with 20 years ago?
They have to spend a lot more money, I think, to stay in the profession, because in Massachusetts, you now have to earn a master's degree within your first 5 years of employment to receive, you know, your certification. So I see them being stressed in a lot of ways, but especially, you know, now they have to pay for that. And not every district reimburses teachers for that kind of expense. And the health insurance costs continue to go up, like I said before.
Right. James was just talking about that. Ruth, thanks for your call. I want to go back to Josh to sort of widen out, if I can, our understanding of how we're supposed to understand the change in the middle class. Josh, you were talking about this shrinkage of over a 15-year period, sort of from 1980 to 1995, and then there was a kind of stabilizing in the latter years of the good 90s. And when you try to pick it apart now to sort of look under the hood of the middle class, is it specifically in manufacturing where you're seeing those jobs with benefits, that sort of life, job for life disappearing?
That's definitely the group that's been hardest hit. I mean, manufacturing employment is still down about 2.5 million relative to its peak in 2001, and it's definitely the most extreme example of that, although I think it's a little more broad-based than that. Mm-hmm. And I would just say one thing about that period in the late 90s. It was a small time period, but I think we really can learn some lessons from it. And the lesson is that 4% unemployment spreads economic benefits around much more equitably than unemployment rates of 5, 6, 7% like we saw in the 1980s and early half of the 90s.
So are you agreeing with what James said when James said, let's not get too hung up on where we are right now? If the overall picture improves, then we can get back to that kind of equity?
I think so. I think it's going to take serious commitment on the part of sort of all the institutions that run our economy. I mean, I'm thinking especially of the Fed, who is already occasionally making noises about being worried about inflation. And I think it's just far too early in what is a pretty weak, fragile recovery to this point to worry about that rather than worry about let's get back to full employment. Let's make sure these benefits are spread around. And so I think the 96 to 2001 period is, you know, real lessons need to be drawn from that. And I would also just agree on the healthcare costs. The one, I think there's real evidence that that is putting a brake on hiring because You've now seen in manufacturing lots of an increase in overtime. And so essentially firms are willing to pay time and a half rather than hire another worker, which essentially means that
take on that benefit load at
exactly.
the same time. Yeah. 1-800-423-8255 to Columbia, South Carolina. And Levi's with us. Hi, Levi.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I was just wanting to make a comment about what your other caller was saying about the millionaires buying the yachts. You know, someday I might get to buy it or whatever. But one of the things he said, you know, how the trickle-down in economics, the guy pumping gas, he's getting to pump more gas or whatever. And what they seem to just kind of be glossing over is the fact that the guy pumping gas – I mean, he's never going to be a millionaire unless he gets another job. I mean, the millionaire is not going to get out and pump the gas. There's always going to be somebody down there pumping gas for the minimum amount of money they can pay somebody.
But isn't that, Levi, I mean, really just a part of what we were all raised with, the idea that you get that job, you're going to get a better job, you're going to get a slightly better job, and someday you're going to be on the other side of that pier watching someone pump gas for you?
Well, you hope to, but, you know, realistically, I believe deep down everybody knows everybody can't be a millionaire. You know what I mean? You want to be a millionaire, but if everybody was a millionaire, then the price of gas would be $50 a gallon, you know?
The funny thing is that for most of the years that I can remember, like being a millionaire was a nice dream, but living a comfortable middle-class life was also something that most people thought, hey, that's pretty good. I'd be happy enough with that. I wonder whether or not, Levi, people are as happy with that dream today as the idea of being on the yacht. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm not happy with that. I want to be a millionaire. But I know lots of people who are happy with that, you know, the middle-class life.
This is good news for the people selling lottery tickets in Columbia, South Carolina.
Yes, they've been booming. But anyhow, that's all I wanted to say.
Thanks for your call, Levi. James, this whole notion of what people can expect, both for themselves and for their kids. I mean, let's be frank. The politicians want us, the politicians who are not in power, want us to believe that, you know, if things continue the way they are, there's going to be this great big gap in America and you'll have the poor people paying to keep the rich people rich. And you're saying to beware a little bit of that message?
Well, I think it's certainly possible. I mean, I think the truth is America has always been a pretty unequal country. I mean, even in the sort of heyday of the post-war era, if you go back and look at the concentration of wealth, et cetera, it's been, you know, pretty – it was always pretty dramatically concentrated in the top. I think the biggest change over the last, say, you know, decade or so, 20 years, has been that people at the top, at the very, very top, are making significantly more income than they ever were. I mean, the top 1%, the amount of money they claim every year is quite extraordinary. But I think that, you know, my impression is Americans have obviously always wanted to be millionaires, but I think the dream of the comfortable middle class is still something that animates a lot of people. And I think it's still in reach. I just think that the kinds of things we need to think about are, you know, as Josh said, I mean, if you get that unemployment rate down, we know that wages rise. I mean, there's no way around that. And I would, again, not to harp too strongly on this, but I think, you know, we have a new job market, one in which people are not, as you said, going to have, for the most part, jobs for life. But we have a whole benefit system, healthcare, et cetera, that was built in a time when people assumed they would have jobs for life. And we have not changed that, and I think that's a serious problem.
Okay, here we are on a radio program talking about the way that Americans work and spend their money and dream for the future. There you are listening to the radio program, actually experiencing that. We'd like to hear how you see the picture. When you look at this country, do you see two Americas? Do you wonder which side you're on, or do you know which side you're on? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me on the program this hour, James Surowiecki. He writes the financial page for The New Yorker. He's got a brand new book out called The Wisdom of Crowds. And Josh Bivens is also with us from the NPR studios in Washington. Josh is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And making sense of, is there one? Are there two Americas? Let's hear from you from Pembroke, Massachusetts. Sam's with us. Hi, Sam.
Hello. Good morning. I think there's three classes in this country. We're basically going further and further towards a feudal system. We got the top 1%. They're the royals. They're making, you know, the top 1 or even 0.5% of our incomes. We've got the vassals who are making from maybe $110,000 a year up to, you know, $10 million a year. They're
right.
The top, you know, 9% after 90. And then there's the rest of us making below $110,000 or so a year. We're the serfs. And for these guys to argue that the American dream is still alive and well, I mean, we've been patting ourselves on the back for years that, oh, over in Britain, they've got a classification, you know, they've got a class system. We don't have it here.
You're not saying, Sam, that somebody is making, or a household that's making $40,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 a year is in the serf class, are you?
It's exactly what I'm saying. They are in the serf class relative to the top, and they're being pushed further and further down. And I have three solutions. I mean, my main question to you folks is this: what do we do about this deepening class system that we have in this country? I think the three solutions are: one, really deep tax reform. I mean, let's go back. I mean, between 1970 and in the year 2000, the tax system has just tilted further and further towards pushing, you know, more and more, less and less responsibility on the top folks and the corporations, and more on the backs of the middle class.
Okay, that tax on yachts and gold rings, but I need you to be quick, Sam. What else are you looking at here?
The other two items are deep health insurance reform. Let's get health insurance off the back of the business and the corporate community.
Okay.
And finally, deep Social Security reform, so it's really an investment system and not a welfare system.
I thank you for your call. I'm going to go to Josh Bivens first and first sort of test whether or not the division that Sam describes is one that you would agree with, Josh.
I don't think I'd characterize it like that. I think I'm worried about some of the same things he is. And I would say I'm worried about two things. I mean, one, you've got the pulling apart, and so you've got an increase in sort of relative inequality. But then if everybody was getting richer, but just the top end was getting richer at a really fast rate and everybody else was getting richer at a slower rate, that'd be less worrisome. But if you look at sort of the median wage earner in the U.S. over the past 20, 25 years, they just have not done well at all. And the median is that person sort of right in the middle of the distribution. Half the people make less than them, half the people make more. And really, they only saw income gains for that sort of four-year period that we've talked about before, the sort of magical 4% unemployment period. And that's what worries me as much as the pulling apart. It's just the fact that it's not everybody's getting richer and some people are getting richer faster. It's some people just aren't moving. And then for the bottom third of the income distribution, they actually saw absolute living standard declines over, say, the late 70s to 1995. And I think those absolute declines are the real as worrisome as the pulling apart in general.
And James, is it fantasy for Sam to talk about the kind of tax reform, health insurance reform, Social Security reform, as long as we're going to have a political class that lives at the upper end rather than the lower end?
Well, what's interesting is I'm not sure that Social Security, the kind of Social Security reform he was talking about, would necessarily be something that the sort of political class would oppose.
No, that's true.
But I actually think I'm not convinced that this sort of separation between the political class and, you know, American people as a whole is exactly what's driving this. But I do think that, you know, as I said before, I think deep health insurance reform, I mean, I think to some extent that has to do with, you know, very powerful lobbies that have a lot invested in keeping the system as it is. But I do think that is kind of essential. And I think arguably, you know, restoring some measure of progressivity to the tax code, you know, is a good idea. I don't think the Bush tax cuts had a negative effect on the economy in the short term, but I think given their long-term consequences, they were, we got incredibly little bang for the buck, and in that sense, I think they were just a terrible idea.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Louisville, Kentucky, and Lavonda is joining us. Hi, Lavonda.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling. What do you see from the chair you're sitting in now?
We're living here in Louisville. There's really been a lot of job losses here, and I feel like that there are two different Americas here, because there are those that are working. I'm even seeing a lot of older people that are having to work at Walmart just to survive, and, you know, because of the two different Americas, losing their jobs. Some are, you know, not allowed to work after a certain age, and that's not with all companies, but most of the manufacturing companies is like that because of the physical work that they're doing.
Used to be, Lavonda, that, you know, if a family found itself in a situation like that and really scraped together the money for a college degree for one of the kids, that was a way out. Is that a way out anymore?
Well, see, I don't feel like that even the college degree even matters, because I will have to speak for myself. I have a college degree, but I'm in a job and in a position where that, you know, I can't use that degree for anything, because I've been in one profession for too long that they don't see that I'm able to do that, even with the grades that I made. So, you know, no matter how you look at it, you're being defeated, basically, and you can't go to where you need to go because of all the, I don't know what's going on. I don't know if it's political or if it's just people in general just saying, well, you know, that person's been in this profession for too long, they can't do anything else.
Is there a fix to this, Lavonda, the way that you see it?
Yes, I believe there are, because not only, you know, having the education, you really can't blame the person not having the education or anything, because I guess maybe the jobs that are out there are not what we think they're supposed to be, or they're not even there, really. We just think that they are. And I think the economy has really went down.
Okay, but are those jobs coming back? Is it simply just a matter of waiting it out?
The jobs that I see are coming back are more professional or more technical or computer-wise, and the people are really older. And they're not really trying to learn those kind of, especially the computer jobs, they're not trying to learn those things. And they're not, you know, even if they get the education for it, who really wants to hire someone who's over 40 or even 50?
Lavonda, thanks for your call. James, just the idea I talked earlier with Josh about the manufacturing jobs. There are also a lot of information jobs, which were a part of the economy 5, 10 years ago, that are not now a part of the economy. Are all those jobs likely to come back in some form, or are we talking about the kind of shift where people like Lavonda and like other people who are listening have to go, wow, I need to drop this trade. I need to start building yachts or something.
Well, I wouldn't say start building yachts. I think that this kind of turmoil in the job market is pretty much, I mean, historically characteristic of the United States. I mean, it's always been an economy that has destroyed a lot of jobs and created a lot of jobs at the same time. I mean, even if you go back and say, look at the Clinton years, the number of jobs that were destroyed during that time, so to speak, destroyed, is quite enormous. And, you know, it's amazing if you go back to, like, the turn of the century, if you go back to 1900 and you look at the list of jobs that were sort of the most common jobs then, it's just radically different. But I do think that, you know, there's a new book out by an MIT economist named Frank Levy called The New Division of Labor. And that book talks about kind of the shift in the job market and the kinds of jobs that, you know, Americans are going to be expected to do. And I do think that, you know, there are shifts in the kinds of jobs that people are going to be expected to do. And, you know, when you say college education now is practically a prerequisite. I mean, it's not, you know, that just gets you in the door. It's not enough to guarantee you a good job. So, you know, I think that, and if you're 40 or 50, it's, you know, that's, it's hard. It's hard to change at that time, at that age.
Next to Van Horn, Iowa, Tom's on the line. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I was wondering if some of the economists could answer a few of my questions, like, evolving different types of jobs from the 1900s or the early 1900s to now, and America's lost jobs and gained more. But I don't think we ever had to battle with the offshoring and the outsourcing and the overseas imports that we're doing today. I don't have a college degree, but I have a skilled trade, a journeyman steam fitter. And here and I work in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which was a main manufacturing center, and it's just been whittled away in the last 20 years.
Are you working now, Tom?
Yes, I am.
And what kind of confidence do you have that the job's going to be there for a year, for 5 years, that sort of thing?
We're low.
Yeah.
Very low. I don't see it happening. The company I worked for got bought out by a giant corporation, and, you know, now it's up in the air. It's like, what's going to happen next? Where are they going to send it, to China or to Mexico or to Indonesia, or, you know, where they can get the cheapest? It's like, you know, the guys that used to make horse carriages, and they said the Model A or the Model T would never take on. Well, but they were still making them in America.
Yeah, now,
you know, Henry Ford did, but now you're making them in some other country. And so what is all this mass of workers that are relatively skilled, maybe not with college degrees, but we can't all work in a hospital and be a registered nurse or a lab technician or a radiologist or, you know.
And is that the prospect that you're facing now, Tom, in terms of going, what next? Is it retraining? It's not a matter of saying, I'm a steam fitter, I can find steam fitting work somewhere, even if I have to move for it. Are you at a stage where you're going, this is a dying trade, I need to find something else?
Well, actually, mine's not. There's always going to have pipes, but there's less buildings that are using pipes for it. We have no steel industry per se left in America. I shouldn't say no, because there's a lot of good steel workers out there, but it isn't like the 60s or the 70s or even the early 90s. We still had, you know, Bethlehem and National Steel, and some of them got in bankruptcy, and there's more and more imported pipe and steel and beams, and it's all being imported. They just opened up a mine up in northern Minnesota in the Mesabi Range. I heard this on National Public Radio about a month ago, for the sole purpose of making taconite to ship it to China. So we're not even using the high-grade ore we're taking out of our
country.
They're sending that, you know, somewhere else. And so
let me, if I can, Tom, turn to Josh Bivens on this, because some of the stuff that I was reading, Josh, says that this country's in a real telltale moment right now, that either the very best of the tax cuts and the mortgage refinancing is past us, and the economy is poised for some kind of greater nosedive, or that there is in fact enough momentum for Tom and other people to, you know, find the work that they need, but we're at a real turning point. Do you buy that?
I think I do buy that. I mean, I was actually more optimistic about a month ago. The March, April, May jobs reports were actually quite good. They're average around 300,000 jobs a month, which is what you really want coming quickly out of into a recovery. But then the June job report came in at about 112,000 jobs, which, as it's been pointed out before, that's not even sufficient to keep pace with population growth. Mm-hmm. And then some of the retail numbers for June came in really weak. And so, I mean, if I had to bet, I would say we're probably in a recovery that's going to last. Maybe everyone isn't going to be perfectly well off in the next year or two, but I didn't think it was as fragile as I now think it might be. I think there's a pretty good chance that we're going to settle into just maybe not outright recession, but really sluggish growth that doesn't do anything for workers' wages. And I would just say one thing on that. I think we've seen the really bad job market over the past couple of years finally start to take a hold of people's wages. And we've actually seen inflation-adjusted wages for production workers decline six of the last 7 months. And I think what you're seeing there is wages take a long time to turn around. It's kind of like turning a cruise ship. And I think the wages that are falling now are sort of what we're reaping from the bad job market in 2002, 2003. And I am a little agnostic about whether or not we're going to have quick enough growth to turn those wages around sometime soon.
James, quick last question for you. We talked earlier about how the corporate executives are sitting on cash and not investing and not creating the jobs that they might to make the changes. What would it take to change their minds?
Well, I think what it's going to take is the recognition. You know, the stock market has been flat now for, or maybe even down slightly for, I don't know, 6 or 8 months. And I think, you know, the stock market, basically, you're investing in the future profits, right? You're investing in the company's future. And the reality is that you simply cannot continue to grow profits at a fast pace if you don't invest. I mean, I believe that, and it's simple. And I think that eventually CEOs are going to have to recognize that and step up to the plate in terms of investing. Now, I don't think that answers a lot of the doubts about, you know, technology and higher productivity, et cetera, that I think are having an impact on the job market. But I do think that once CEOs sort of break out of that shell, that's going to be the fundamental driver. But it may take a while for them to do that.
All right. James, thanks for being with us on the program today. James Surowiecki writes the financial page for The New Yorker magazine. And Josh Bivens, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Josh is an economist, at the Economic Policy Institute, joining us there from the NPR studios in Washington. Earlier in the program, we talked with Phil Bennett, senior sales director for the Hinckley Company in Southwest Harbor, a company that makes fancy yachts, and Larry Greenbaum, director of the Jewish Vocational Services Office in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Venalosa, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Susan Shepard, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Micah Sieber and Nadia Usayev. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.